content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the November 9th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Uncle Sam with a very dour look on his face. He's standing in the foreground. There's an American flag and a couple of empty gas cans. And in the background is a, sort of a standard suburban house just completely going up in flames. And the title is A Burning House, Partisan Hatred, Anti-Semitism, and America's Lost Ideals. And that certainly is the topic of our first main story. We'll start right there. Synagogue slaughter, mail bombs stun the U.S. What happened? The nation this week mourned the victims of the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in American history, with many questioning whether a toxic political environment had made the massacre more likely. 11 worshipers were killed and 6 others wounded when a gunman armed with a legally purchased AR-15-style assault rifle stormed into Pittsburgh's Tree of Life synagogue shouting, "Kill all Jews." The 46-year-old gunman, Robert Bowers, had a history of making virulently anti-Semitic online posts. Bowers complained online that President Trump was being controlled by globalists and Jewish interests, and that a caravan of Central American migrants headed to the United States was funded by Jews. "I can't sit by and watch my people get slaughtered," Bowers wrote shortly before the killings. "Screw your optics. I'm going in." The attack came the same week as Cesar Sayoc, a 56-year-old Florida man and enthusiastic Trump supporter, was arrested on charges of mailing more than a dozen homemade bombs to Democratic politicians and media organizations criticized by the president. A white man in Kentucky also shot 2 black people to death in a Kroger grocery store after he tried and failed to enter a nearby black church. The shooter, Gregory A. Bush, a white 51-year-old, reportedly told a bystander that whites don't shoot whites. President Trump was greeted by protests while visiting Pittsburgh in the aftermath of the attacks, after he rebuffed the Democratic mayor's request for him to stay away until after the funerals. Demonstrators carried signs saying, "Words matter, and President hate is not welcome in our state." Trump pushed back against criticism that he encouraged the recent wave of violence with his rhetoric, blaming the fake news media, the true enemy of the people, for stoking anger. What the editorial said: "A real leader would try to bring the country together after a tragedy," said the Boston Globe. Instead, President Trump is blaming everyone but himself for a hateful political climate that has emboldened violent extremists. Trump has openly endorsed violence against his critics, praising a congressman who body slammed a reporter and encouraging fans at his rallies to knock the crap out of protesters. And when white nationalists and neo-Nazis marched through the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia last year chanting, "Jews will not replace us," Trump infamously said they included some very fine people. From there, it's easy to connect the dots between the bully-in-chief and Pittsburgh. "It is no secret that anti-Semites and white supremacists have felt emboldened in recent years," said the National Review. "But the idea that Trump is somehow responsible for these crimes is facile and toxic. Overheated rhetoric is par for the course in American politics. Those culpable for acts of violence are the individuals who perpetrate them. The rush to blame Trump for the synagogue massacre is especially sickening." Bowers, a hardened anti-Semite, thought the president was a closet globalist being manipulated by the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. This attack was committed in service of a distinct ancient evil. The proper response is mourning in solidarity with the Jewish community. There are more enduring and important things than tribal political fighting. What the columnist said: if you think Trump should bring down the temperature, you have a point, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. But let's not forget Democrats routinely accuse Republicans of wanting to kill the poor and young, of trying to destroy the planet, of being terrorists after every school shooting. So if you tell Trump to cool things down without mentioning all the extreme rhetoric on the left, you don't really care about the temperature. Trump's defenders note that his son-in-law, daughter, and grandchildren are Jewish, said Charles Sykes in WeeklyStandard.com, and that he is staunchly pro-Israel. And yet he has clearly given oxygen to anti-Semitic narratives. During the closing days of the presidential campaign, Trump ran a shocking TV ad portraying Hillary Clinton as secretly conspiring with global financial powers to rob our working class. The ad showed pictures of Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, Democratic donor George Soros, and Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen, all Jews. His campaign also retweeted an image of Clinton inside a Jewish star. When prominent Jews and Jewish journalists criticize Trump, they are invariably inundated with anti-Semitic threats and images of concentration camps, actions Trump has refused to denounce. It's not an accident that the flagrantly anti-Semitic alt-right and white supremacists believe Trump is on their side. What is happening to our country? Asks Max Boot in the Washington Post. I've always thought of political terrorism and religious violence as something that happened over there, in places like the Balkans and the Middle East. Now the horror show has arrived on our shores. When I grew up in Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue and the surrounding Jewish community, said Howard Feynman in the New York Times, I was taught that America was a kind of promised land, the one nation besides Israel where Jews could live, unburdened by fear. But my faith has been shaken. Throughout history, Jews have been the canaries in the coal mine of social and political collapse. Beware, hatred of the other is poisoning our public life. And even though the elections will have happened by the time you hear this, we'll read the second main story, which talks about Trump, Democrats, and final midterms push. What happened? President Trump embarked on a whirlwind 8-state campaign tour this week in a last-minute drive to keep the House and Senate in Republican hands in the November 6 midterm elections. As the week went to press, polling site 538.com gave Republicans an 85% chance of holding the Senate. It also gave the Democrats an 85% chance of winning at least the 23 seats they need to regain control of the House of Representatives. It's going to be a great night for America, said House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi. Early turnout surged in several key states. In Florida, more than 3 million people had cast ballots a week before the vote, a state record. Early voting was also up in Texas, where lines at polling stations snaked around the block, and in Georgia, where Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams was locked in a close race with Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. With the campaign in its final stages, both parties made their closing pitches to voters. Democrats attacked the GOP's record on health care and tax cuts, and the party's reluctance to defy Trump. Meanwhile, the president talked up his crackdown on illegal immigration, vowing to end birthright citizenship, and warned of the dangers of handling Democrats' political power. The party, he said at a Houston rally, will take a giant wrecking ball to the extraordinary prosperity that we've all achieved. Both parties are expected to spend a total of $5.2 billion on the midterms, making it the most expensive in U.S. history. What the editorial said, Trump has served up some of his finest demagoguery on the campaign trail, said the New York Times. That's drowned out his subtler return to the broadly popular policy themes of his 2016 campaign. He's promised to tackle spiraling prescription drug costs and spend big on American infrastructure. If they win the House, Democrats should consider these areas on which the president and Democratic lawmakers might actually be able to get something done. Liberals may doubt Trump's willingness to reach across the aisle, but remember, the man likes to win. The battle for Congress is the main event this election, said the Wall Street Journal. But the fight for control of 36 governorships may be as consequential. Republicans hold 26 of the state houses up for grabs, and the stakes are worth highlighting. In Michigan, Ohio, and elsewhere, Republicans have slashed taxes. In Wisconsin, they've brought union monopolies to heel. In Georgia, they've resisted Obamacare's costly Medicaid expansion. If Democrats win back those governors' mansions, it will mean a dramatic move to the policy left in much of the country. What the columnist said, above all else, this election is a referendum on Donald Trump, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. It's a vote between the GOP's base and those who think there should be some sort of break to slow his disintegration of American life and his despoilment of the national spirit. No matter what happens on November 6, the GOP is likely to lurch further rightward, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Should the Democrats win the House but not the Senate, they will be working with an even more hardened foe. Moderate GOP representatives are the most likely to lose their seats. Those who survive will be the reddest of the red. And if Republicans hold on to Congress, we will see a Trumpian party that feels invincible. It's also inevitable that this election will deepen America's geographic and demographic fault lines, said Ronald Brownstein in CNN.com. Democrats' top opportunities to capture Republican-held seats are concentrated in well-educated, higher-income, and preponderantly white districts. Most of these are centered in thriving suburbs where Trump faces resistance, especially from women on cultural and personal grounds. Republican support in blue-collar rural and ex-urban areas, meanwhile, is sure to solidify. This division will shape American politics for years to come. The big question is how Democrats will handle a divided Capitol if they take the House, said Bill Scheer in RealClearPolitics.com, because even the biggest blue waves can't wash away Trump's veto pen. One thing is clear. Impeachment will likely not be at the top of the Democratic to-do list. If the party wins the chamber, it will be because of candidates who triumphed in districts Trump took in 2016. Those Democrats will not want to alienate the very Trump voters who aided their victory. Controversy of the week is titled Political Violence, How a Domestic Terrorist Became Radicalized. For two long years, the man now sitting in the Oval Office has demonized his opponents and divided the nation, said John Avlon in CNN.com. And now we are starting to reap the seeds he has sown. FBI agents investigating the recent mail bomb campaign to two former Democratic presidents, two former CIA directors, and other critics of President Trump last week arrested Cesar Sayoc, 56, of Florida, a Make America Great Again hat-wearing Trump superfan Sayoc plastered his van with images of Trump and his favorite rhetorical targets, including Hillary Clinton, George Soros, and CNN, superimposed with red crosshairs. Right-wing conspiracy nuts, including popular radio host Rush Limbaugh, had been suggesting that the bombs would turn out to be a false flag attack sent by liberals to smear Trump supporters, said Rick Wilson in the DailyBeast.com. But no, the MAGA bomber was a true Trumpist, one of the millions he's radicalized and inspired to wage war against those he describes as enemies of the people. Why blame Trump and not the actual criminal, said Kimberly Ross in WashingtonExaminer.com. Sayoc is an obvious madman whose first bomb-related brush with the law came back in 2002 when, unable to pay his electric bill, he threatened a bomb attack on Florida Power and Light. Yet Democrats tried to score political points by blaming the president and, by extension, the GOP for a deranged individual's actions. How soon the Democrats forget, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It was only last year that James Hodgkinson, a rabid supporter of socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, shot up the GOP's congressional baseball team practice, critically wounding Representative Steve Scalise. At that time, no serious person suggested that Bernie Sanders had created James Hodgkinson. So why blame Trump for Sayoc? Unlike Sanders, Trump has actually endorsed political violence, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. During the 2016 campaign, Trump encouraged his febrile supporters to beat up protesters and warned that the Second Amendment people might have to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing liberal judges. In office, he's called Democrats evil, lamented the infestation of immigrant criminals, and just last week praised GOP Representative Greg Gianforte as my kind of guy for body slamming a journalist. Trump supporters are listening, said Mehdi Hassan in TheIntercept.com. The incidence of hate crimes has risen every year since 2015, with one in five perpetrators, according to one study, explicitly citing their support for Trump while beating, shooting, knifing, bombing, or driving a car into Muslims, Hispanics, blacks, and liberals. The sooner we all recognize that the President of the United States is helping to radicalize a new generation of angry far-right men, the better. Trump bears much of the blame, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, but he's been aided and abetted by Fox News and the rest of the right-wing media machine. Up until 2016, Sayoc's social media postings were mundane and apolitical, and then his tone turned dark and paranoid, with stories from right-wing sites about illegal immigration, Islamic terrorism, and Clinton conspiracies. The overwhelming majority of Republicans are not violent, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. But as the party followed Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Fox, and then Trump further and further into the far-right fever swamps, the GOP has become a petri dish for diseased minds. Millions now revel in racism, hatred, and kooky conspiracy theories. It was statistically inevitable that some of those kooks would resort to violence. And let's see what we've got in our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for second thoughts. After rapper Kanye West announced he was distancing myself from politics because he realized I've been used to spread messages I don't believe in. West recently made an Oval Office appearance to express his love for President Trump. It was a good week for happy endings with the recovery of a 10-foot-tall model of the human colon that had been stolen from the University of Kansas. In a tweet hashtagged stolen colon, police said that officers found the giant inflatable pilfered intestine in a vacant house. And it was a good week for coaching after HBO hired an intimacy coordinator to make actors feel more comfortable while filming sex scenes. But it was a bad week for playing host to 6,000 U.S. troops after Americans who were deployed to Iceland for a NATO training exercise almost drained Reykjavik, the capital city, of beer. We had to send people out of the bar to our warehouses to bring beer back as quickly as possible, said bartender Ingvar Svensson. It was a bad week for interfaith solidarity after Vice President Mike Pence appeared with a rabbi at a unity rally honoring the victims of the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre. The rabbi, Lauren Jacobs, is actually a messianic Jew, an evangelical group that tries to convert Jews to Christianity, and he was stripped of the title rabbi in 2003. And finally, it was a bad week for Julian Assange after a judge in Ecuador ruled that the WikiLeaks founder, who has been living at the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid extradition, must keep the bathroom tidy and clean up after his pet cat. Assange had claimed that the embassy's cleanliness requirements violated his fundamental rights and freedoms. And before we move on, we'll read this boring but important item. BBI, Obama's climate goals still in sight. The U.S. is on track to meet the targets established by President Obama's signature climate policy, the Clean Power Plan, despite the Trump White House's aggressive efforts to roll back its requirements. According to a U.S. report released this week, the power sector's carbon dioxide emissions have fallen 28% since 2005, ahead of schedule to meet the Clean Power Plan goal of reducing emissions by 32% before 2030. Emissions lower last year than at any point since 1987 have fallen because power producers have largely gravitated away from coal. In August, the Trump administration proposed a replacement plan that would let coal-fired plants release 12 times more CO2 into the atmosphere than the Obama-era standards. And the briefing page article this week goes back in history a little. The title, The Legacy of World War I. The Great War ended 100 years ago this month. How does it still shape our world now? What caused the war? In 1914, the great powers of Europe were enmeshed in a tangled web of alliances that had formed over decades of colonial empires jockeying for dominance. The assassination of the Austro-Hungarian Archduke Franz Ferdinand by a 19-year-old Bosnian Serb activist started a chain reaction that plunged these nations into a cataclysmic struggle. Austria-Hungary, which had been looking for an opportunity to project strength in the Balkans, declared war on Serbia, accusing its government of orchestrating the attack. Russia then mobilized to defend its ally Serbia. This led Germany, which was allied with Austria-Hungary, to declare war on Russia and its ally France, and to invade France's neighbor, neutral Belgium. Britain, which had promised to protect Belgian neutrality, then declared war on Germany, which it had been battling for naval supremacy. In the 4 years that followed, some 9.7 million soldiers and 10 million civilians died in a conflict so ghastly that many survivors returned with shell shock, haunted by what they had witnessed. Why did so many die? Technology. The introduction of machine guns, barbed wire, and highly accurate artillery made advancing over open ground tantamount to a suicide run. Nevertheless, military leaders still clung to 19th century tactics for much of the war, ordering massed infantry assaults meant to overrun enemy positions. But when soldiers left their trenches and went over the top, they were mowed down by the thousands. The industrialization of war produced death on an unprecedented scale. In France, for example, 13.3% of the male population between the ages of 15 and 49 died in the war. The fighting provided a grim preview of even greater horrors to come, with first widespread use of military aircraft, bombing of civilians, chemical weapons, and armored tanks. World War I was the first calamity of the 20th century, wrote historian Fritz Stern, the calamity from which all other calamities sprang. What followed the war? The war's end set the stage for a new series of global conflicts, some of which are still raging today. In Russia, war fatigue led directly to the collapse of the centuries-old Romanov dynasty, the 1917 Russian Revolution, and the establishment of communist rule. The polyglot empire of defeated Austria-Hungary was dissolved into a collection of independent states based on ethnic identity, including former Yugoslavia, that are riddled with nationalist and sectarian tensions to this day. The harsh terms imposed by the victors in the Treaty of Versailles helped lead to a surge of nationalism in Germany and ultimately to the rise of Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party. Some historians see World War I as the beginning of a continuous struggle for Europe that didn't really end until the reunification of Germany in 1989. What about the rest of the world? After World War I, the Allies stripped Germany of its colonies in Asia and Africa. But instead of being given independence, these long-oppressed lands were absorbed into the victors' colonial empires. Colonized people resented being denied the right to national self-determination, extended to newly created or liberated European countries like Poland, fueling independence movements in India and several African nations. World War I also redrew the map of the Middle East. The British and French carved up the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, which had entered the war on Germany's side. Under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, France claimed Lebanon and Syria for its sphere of influence, while Britain took control of what became Iraq and Jordan, as well as the Gulf states. The new borders were arbitrarily drawn, with no regard for long-standing religious and tribal identities. Iraq, for example, was created by lumping three former Ottoman provinces together, dominated respectively by Shias, Sunnis, and Kurds. When ISIS swept across Syria and Iraq, its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, declared his intention to erase the old colonial borders. "This blessed advance will not stop until we hit the last nail in the coffin of the Sykes-Picot conspiracy," he said. What was the impact on the U.S.? America reluctantly entered the war on the side of the Allies in 1917, but its late intervention powered the exhausted and nearly bankrupt Allies to victory. The war made the U.S. the world's leading creditor, shifting the seat of global finance from London to New York City. Untouched at home by the ravages of war while Europe was devastated, America saw its economy boom, surpassing the British Empire to become the largest in the world. President Woodrow Wilson hoped to shape a post-war order with the League of Nations, which was designed to prevent future wars. But the Senate rejected joining the League, with opponents calling it incompatible with American sovereignty. Nevertheless, Wilson's declaration that the world must be made safe for democracy set a precedent that has endured. That has been the foundation of almost all American foreign policy for the last 100 years, said historian A. Scott Berg. whether you agree with it or not. And we'll go into a few of the columns, starting with Bursting the Avenatti Bubble. It's time for Democrats to show celebrity attorney Michael Avenatti the door, said Ed Kilgore. Stormy Daniels' belligerent, Trump-trolling lawyer is acting as if he really believes he's a genuine candidate for the 2020 Democratic nomination. Avenatti has met with political consultants and even visited the key primary states of Iowa and New Hampshire. Some Democrats, tired of seeing Trump beat up his opponents, are buying Avenatti's argument that they need their own Trump to win back the White House. But do Democrats really want to run their own shady bully for president? Like Trump, Avenatti has a dodgy financial history. He's accused of owing millions in unpaid taxes. He's already had one of Daniels' harassing lawsuits against Trump dismissed, with Daniels ordered to pay Trump's legal fees. Avenatti also undermined the credible sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh by bringing in a client with dubious accusations. To run a candidate as recklessly combative as Trump only plays into the president's hands, eliminating the undertow of basic decency that keeps his approval ratings underwater. Democrats have a real chance in 2020 if they run a qualified, smart, likable candidate voters can respect, not a mirror image of Trump. This is from Germany. The Merkel era draws to an end. With one brisk announcement, the mightiest woman in Europe became a proverbial lame duck, said Joachim Dorfs in the Stuttgarter Zeitung. After her center-right Christian Democratic Union Party suffered its worst election result since 1966 in the wealthy central state of Hesse this week, Chancellor Angela Merkel said she would step down as the CDU leader this December and would not seek re-election as chancellor in 2021. The normally stoic Merkel, 64, looked almost happy as she announced her impending retirement after 13 years as Germany's leader and 18 years as the CDU chief. "Get ready for the time after me," she said. In essence, Merkel quit before she could be fired. Her party power base has eroded, and her lawmakers recently ousted her longtime ally Volker Kauder as the Conservatives' floor leader in the German legislature. The Hesse election, like the one in Bavaria 2 weeks ago, showed that the CDU and its allies are bleeding voters, not only to the far-right Alternative for Germany, the AfD, but also to the leftist Greens. Merkel's star has been fading since 2015, said Alexander Jungkunz in Nürnberger Nachrichten, when she single-handedly forced Germans to accept nearly a million asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East. The consequences of that decision, which she imposed on a reluctant CDU, have dominated politics ever since. Germans have grappled with the spotty success of integration, the dysfunctional system to deport rejected asylum seekers, and a rise in crime, committed both by the newcomers and those who hate them. The anger over refugees was quickly exploited by the far-right AfD with its battle cry of "Merkel must go." The leader nicknamed Mother was always a pragmatic centrist, said Robert Missick in Die Zeit. The migrant crisis simply exposed her differences with the right. For more than a decade, she kept Germany steadily and solidly at the center of Europe. She has been a bulwark against the increasingly shrill right-wing leaders who have taken power in Italy, Poland, Hungary, and elsewhere, the embodiment of decency amid the agitation, of quiet amid the yelling. Unfortunately, she also steered the CDU away from its heritage and tradition, said ULF Porschak and DeWitt. Under Merkel, the CDU oversaw a phase-out of nuclear power, an end to the mandatory military conscription, and a halt to tax cuts, policies that had once been central to the party. The CDU must become a truly conservative party again if it is to reclaim the right. Merkel says she is willing to stay in office until 2021, said Jürgen Kabi in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. But now that her grand coalition with the center-left Social Democratic Party is faltering, it's likely that she will be replaced in early elections next year. Supporters and detractors alike will miss her completely scandal-free, fair, and democratic leadership. She'd be great in the ceremonial but morally important post of president. And in 2022, that position will be open. And finally, from Israel, how to keep from being recognized. Israeli intelligence agents have come up with some clever tools to fool the facial recognition technology that threatens their espionage efforts, said Yonah Jeremy Bob. Facial recognition tech is now so advanced that it can identify people even if they're wearing fake beards and mustaches. And in a rare public speech last week, Mossad director Yossi Cohen admitted that spying is getting harder because facial recognition programs can expose Israeli agents who are working undercover abroad. But Israeli ingenuity is solving that problem. The firm D-ID, founded by former military intelligence officer Gil Perry, sells software that can subtly distort an individual's face in digital photo, so that a computer won't be able to match that image to a real person. The tool can be deployed to protect photos stored in government databases or used in business marketing materials. And Mossad has eyeglasses that use infrared light or flashes to fool facial recognition, as well as an infrared device that can be hidden under a baseball hat, umbrella, or wig and project dots of light onto the wearer's face. That light show can obscure agents' identity or even allow them to impersonate somebody else. The recognition, anti-recognition tech race is now roaring ahead at full speed. The last word feature this week is titled, Why the Migrants Still Come. Sneaking from Mexico into the U.S. has become increasingly difficult, said Nick Miroff. But applying for asylum offers Central Americans a legal way to gain entry, if they can make it to the border. Crouched low in the brush along the riverbank, Border Patrol agent Robert Rodriguez watched the Mexican side of the Rio Grande, waiting. A Norteño ballad drifted from a radio somewhere on a nearby farm, and two pigs cooled themselves at the water's edge, waiting to their bellies. For a moment, one of the border's busiest places for illegal crossings looked placid. Then a raft appeared. Within seconds, it was in the water, a teenage guide steering the current while his boss, an older man, stood watch on the bank. In less than a minute, the teenager delivered a woman and a boy to the U.S. side, and they climbed out, shoes sinking in the wet silt. Rodriguez stepped onto the path to stop them, but the woman and boy did not run. They wanted to be captured. This is how it works. The era of mass migration by Mexican laborers streaming into California and the deserts of Arizona is over. Billions spent on fencing, sensors, agents, and drones have hardened the border and made it tougher than ever to sneak into the United States. The migrants coming today are increasingly Central Americans seeking asylum or some form of humanitarian protection, bearing stories of torture, gang recruitment, abusive spouses, extortionists, and crooked police. They know the quickest path to a better life in the United States is now an administrative one, not through mountains or canyons, but through the front gates of the country's immigration bureaucracy. Last year, U.S. immigration courts received nearly 120,000 asylum claims from migrants facing deportation, a fourfold increase from 2014. Those filings have pushed the number of pending cases before U.S. immigration courts to more than 750,000, collapsing the system and upending President Donald Trump's sweeping promises to lock down the border. This past spring, Trump fixated on a caravan of asylum seekers traveling through Mexico, about 300 of whom eventually crossed into the United States. Now, a much larger procession of as many as 7,000 Central Americans is trekking north toward the border, despite threats from the president to stop them with U.S. troops and sever aid to their countries. Families are coming in caravans and on their own because it works. Only 1.4% of migrant family members from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador who crossed the border illegally in 2017 have been deported to their home countries, according to the Department of Homeland Security. There is a sinking feeling among DHS officials that more caravans are yet to come and that they will only get larger. As Rodriguez radioed another agent to pick up the woman and the boy, she handed him her Honduran identification card. Cecilia Ulloa was 25. Darwin, her son, was 13. The math took a moment to sink in, and Ulloa appeared to recognize a familiar look of confusion. "My stepfather," she said. "It started when I was 10. After a decade in prison for rape, her stepfather was free now, stalking them, blaming her for ruining his life. "He's going to kill us." Police in Honduras had told her there was nothing they could do, she said, so she and her son left for the United States. They wanted asylum. Chances were they would be denied, but it could take months or longer for the U.S. immigration system to determine whether Ulloa and her son deserved protection. They would probably not be sent back to Honduras anytime soon. Some migrant stories of gang threats and police indifference have a rehearsed quality, suggesting they are concocted. The smuggling guides who charge $10,000 or more for the trip provide transportation and meals, but also coaching, including the key words migrants should say to convince U.S. asylum officials that their fears meet credible standards. But there are many with no need to make things up. The countries they are running from have some of the highest murder rates in the world. Their criminal justice systems barely function. Some have been victimized already. For people like Ulloa and her son, here's how it works. Those who cross the border and turn themselves in are interviewed by a U.S. asylum officer to determine whether they have a credible fear of facing persecution back home. The Supreme Court has ruled that an asylum seeker's fear is considered well-founded if there is a 10% chance they will face persecution, and those who potentially qualify are referred to an immigration judge. Between October 1, 2017, the start of the 2018 fiscal year, and June 30th, the period for which the most recent statistics are available, the government received more than 73,000 credible fear claims, up from 5,000 during all of 2009. Of those 73,000 who were interviewed, 76% were found to have a credible fear of return. The finding does not mean that a judge will eventually grant asylum. Justice Department statistics show that fewer than 10% of Central American applicants are awarded asylum, but the process of applying offers a shield from deportation and a toehold, however tenuous, in the United States. Under Trump, asylum denial rates have reached their highest levels in more than a decade, but nearly half of those rulings are issued in absentia, because the applicant does not appear in court. This is the breach Trump officials see. If asylum seekers think their case is likely to be denied, they can drop out of the court system and disappear, remaining in the United States illegally. In the absence of a physical wall, the Trump administration is laying down new barriers to the asylum process. The U.S. immigration court system is a branch of the Justice Department, not the judiciary, and the Attorney General effectively functions as a one-man Supreme Court. In June, Jeff Sessions issued a sweeping ruling that overturned the case of a Guatemalan domestic violence victim who had demonstrated that police failed to protect her from spousal abuse and rape. Sessions' ruling said asylum laws are meant to shelter those facing persecution for political or religious beliefs or their membership in a well-defined social group, not those fleeing what he called private forms of violence. Asylum seekers who make their claims at official border crossings, not on the banks of the Rio Grande, are not breaking the law, but U.S. agents have to let them cross the bridge first. On a recent morning in South Texas, immigration lawyer Jennifer Harberry walked across the river into Mexico under a blazing sun, waiting for a nun to pick her up. They drove to Reynosa Migrant Shelter in a bullet-scarred neighborhood full of cartel lookouts and stash houses used by smugglers to stage illegal crossings. Harberry is an irritant to U.S. border officials as well as to the cartels. She provides free legal advice and assistance to asylum seekers. So the nuns who run the shelter call her often to see whether she can help migrant families desperate for legal advice. Harberry's pro bono work takes profits away from traffickers because they charge a tax of several hundred dollars to those who cross illegally along the river. They earn nothing from the migrants Harberry escorts to the official border crossing. Harberry is one of the activists who also help asylum seekers stranded in the no-man's land on the pedestrian bridge over the river. In recent months, U.S. officers have been turning migrants away, telling them to come back later. Harberry and others have criticized the practice as unlawful, but DHS officials say that port officers have multiple responsibilities and that busy border crossings have capacity limits. It was Harberry who provided ProPublica with the surreptitious audio recording of a child screaming for her mother that dealt a severe blow to the family separation policy. She has absorbed the stories of thousands of asylum seekers and views her job with the urgency of an emergency responder. She intends to help as many asylum seekers enter the United States as possible because she believes she is saving their lives. "These people have the most horrifying stories I have ever heard," she said. "I don't think people have better claims than those running from the cartels." The nuns had asked Harberry to help a young mother stranded for more than a week, Maria Magdalena Gonzalez, 21, and her son, Emiliano, 3. A gangster in Gonzalez's home state of Guerrero, Mexico, was threatening to kill her for rejecting his advances. But when she and her son tried to approach the U.S. border crossing a few days earlier to seek asylum, they had been turned away. With more and more Central Americans showing up at the port of entry, U.S. officers had set up an impromptu checkpoint over the middle of the Rio Grande, blocking them from setting foot on the U.S. side to start the asylum process. Those who fail to cross are put at risk, because cartel lookouts ply the Mexican side of the bridge, watching for Central Americans who have been turned away. The migrants are prime targets for kidnapping because criminal groups assume they have relatives living in the United States with enough money to pay a ransom. Harberry was there to make sure Gonzalez and her son weren't rejected again. A nun drove them to a bridge over the river, and Harberry walked alongside them until a Mexican immigration official stood in the way. He had been looking for asylum seekers from Central America, but Gonzalez and her son were Mexican, so there was nothing he could do to detain them. He told Harberry the U.S. agents had not been letting asylum seekers through or making others wait 3 or 4 days to be allowed to approach the American side. Harberry, Gonzalez, and the boy continued walking until three American officers blocked them halfway across the bridge. "We want asylum," Gonzalez said softly, more a question than a demand. An agent told her to stand aside and wait. Harberry asked how long, and the officer said it could be several hours, perhaps days. She sat on the pavement with Gonzalez and the boy. "We'll wait," she said. The officers appeared to notice a reporter taking notes and called a supervisor. He arrived and waved everyone through. Gonzalez reached the inspection booth and pushed her paperwork forward. Harberry gave her a hug and an invitation to dinner. Then the officers directed Gonzalez and her son to an adjacent waiting room. "They made it," Harberry said. She waved goodbye through the glass. The room wasn't full, not even close. There were more than 60 chairs in the waiting area, and all but two were empty. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And we're on the Talking Points page. We will start with the article titled, "Megyn Kelly, NBC's $69 million Mistake." When Megyn Kelly last week made a jaw-dropping defense of white people wearing blackface on Halloween, said James Poniewozik in the New York Times, why did her bosses at NBC act so surprised? NBC fired Kelly after the morning show host's comments. She insisted blackface wasn't racist if it was part of a costume, angered network colleagues, and generated embarrassing headlines. But anyone who knew anything about her career could have seen this coming. Before jumping ship for NBC, Kelly's meteoric rise at Fox News was fueled by racial demagoguery, said Kirsten Powers in USA Today. She insisted that black parents tell their kids that Santa Claus just is white. Jesus, too. Complained that the black community has a thug mentality. Repeatedly said blacks shot or brutalized by cops brought it on themselves. And laughed off a Fox Chiron describing Michelle Obama as Obama's baby mama. At NBC, she tried to temper her instincts, but her sharp-elbowed persona produced mediocre ratings. The network seemed relieved to be done with her, despite likely having to pay Kelly her $69 million contract in full. Kelly's apology should have been accepted, said Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. Surely when no offense is intended, none should be taken. Ah, but liberals love to be offended, which gives them an excuse to exercise power, to intimidate, to terrorize. If free speech still matters, broadcasters must be allowed to be wrong without being canceled, said Emily Jahinsky in TheFederalist.com. The whole point of the panel conversation Kelly was moderating was to air different opinions about Halloween costumes. Had she not voiced her authentic views, she and her like-minded viewers would not have been educated about the ugly history of blackface. Kelly was simply mismatched for her Happy Talk morning show job at NBC, said Caitlin Flanagan in TheAtlantic.com. On Fox, the former attorney displayed a kind of badass conservatism matched with an obvious and quick intelligence. When she went to NBC, Kelly announced, "I am kind of done with politics for now," said Megan Garber, also in TheAtlantic.com. But the Fox Tiger couldn't change her stripes. You have to wonder, though, what would have happened had Kelly's ratings been high? NBC would be trying to convince its audience Kelly's question about blackface was innocent and a learning opportunity for all. And just time for a few shorter notes, starting with, the number of women in state prisons has increased by more than 800% over the past four decades. primarily because of the war on drugs. More than 250,000 children in the U.S. have a mother in jail. Compared with President Obama's second term, the Trump administration has tripled the amount of public land available to be leased for drilling by oil and gas companies to 12.8 million acres. Royalties the companies pay to the government have been lowered and environmental restrictions eased. Climate change is already redrawing climate zones, expanding the tropics and the Sahara Desert, shifting the boundary of the arid western U.S. plains 140 miles eastward, and moving Tornado Alley 500 miles east, according to a new Yale study. President Trump continues to devote large blocks of his schedule to executive time, unstructured periods the president typically uses to send tweets, call friends, and watch cable television. In a recent week in October, his schedule was empty every day until 11 a.m., and on Tuesday of that week, Trump had 9 hours of executive time and 3 hours for official duties. On the poll watch, 56% of Americans think that President Trump has not been tough enough on Saudi Arabia after its agents killed dismembered journalist Jamal Khashoggi. 32% say that Trump's response was about right, and 5% think the president was too tough. And we will finish out the hour with a quote from philosopher Rene Descartes, quoting in the Albuquerque Journal. He says, "Perfect numbers, like perfect men, are very rare." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.